Gary.
Hey, Patrick, how's it going?
You got a sec?
You bet. What's up?
I'm hoping you help me out on a little something bugging me. I missed Ash Wednesday this year.
Really?
Yeah. I was kind of embarrassed about it. I didn't want anyone to know, so I went ahead and I did the ashes myself.
Well, to the untrained eye, you know, it's fine, I guess. Yeah. What is that? Is that shoe polish?
No, it's maple syrup.
Here, why don't you take it? Yeah. Okay, so the bad news is you missed... No, that's right. The bad news is you missed Ash Wednesday, okay? But the good news is you can still have plenty of time to start your Lent plans.
I was hoping you would say that.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I thought I would go the goal-setting route this year.
Okay.
Because I don't like giving stuff up.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've already started working on my list. They're pretty much all solid goals.
Oh, you're redoing your New Year's resolutions.
Hmm.
All right, so what do we got? Walk on the moon, run for president. Okay, sequence DNA.
Yeah, no, hang on, that's next year's. Those are for 2015. Flip that over.
Oh, here we go. All right. Yeah. Lose weight. Patrick, do you really need to lose weight?
No, but I thought I'd start with something easy. I don't get that ball rolling.
Okay.
It's already crossed off.
I see that. Okay, that's a good one. Stop gossiping.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. No, no. I don't want to be anything like my cousin Tom, you know, with the
yeah.
And my friend Sheila, you know, ever since she had that
thing. That's not bad. You know, I mean, it's not bad to have personal goals, but really, Lent is about picking one or two things that you can do to help improve your relationship with God.
Oh, this is going to be easier than I thought.
I know. It's going to be very easy, right? Let's start simple. Let's think. Okay, hey, you have a Bible, right?
Oh, yeah. It's right on my nightstand.
Perfect. Easy access.
Well, it's not easy access. I mean, right now I'm using it to prop up the TV so I can watch that Honey Boo Boo show.
Okay. All right. What about this? Read the Bible between episodes.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I could do that.
All right. And what else? What else? You eat occasionally.
Yeah, a couple times a day.
Before every meal, take a couple moments, pray. Boom.
Piece of cake.
I know. Easy peasy, right?
No. All this talk about food's kind of made me hungry for cake.
Oh.
I guess I should really think about something I could give up. I mean, isn't that the point of Lent?
That is. You're catching on. Yeah. Is there anything maybe that you're doing that's just wasting your time that you could be spending with him?
No, nothing I can think of.
Nothing.
Zip.
Seriously?
Got nothing.
Okay, just a thought. Mm-hmm. Just a thought. What about not watching Honey Boo Boo for just a few weeks? You could TiVo it, all right? Later on, Honey Boo Boo Marathon.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how to hit a guy where it hurts.
Well.
But, hey. I'm all about the sacrifice. You know?
I know you are.
Okay.
And you're, yes, just set aside a little time every day to improve your relationship with him. That's it.
Sounds great. Thanks,
right.
Gary. Appreciate it. Right. Oh, hey, one more thing.
Yeah.
Can I borrow your TiVo?
Poor Patrick. Yeah, you can clap for that. That's hilarious. But poor Patrick. Patrick is so close. He's so close. He understands. He gets it. He has some sort of a head knowledge of this whole season that we're in, the season of Lent, the season that spans the 40 days, not counting Sundays, from Ash Wednesday, which was just about a week and a half ago, to Easter. The 40 days that are a time that are marked, that are set aside as a time of enrichment, of renewal, of really focusing in on our faith. And in that, you know, Lent literally means spring, which... If you're anything like me, you wake up this morning and you look outside and you say, well, obviously, it looks like spring right now. I mean, nothing says spring like a couple fresh inches of snow. Maybe we should start there tonight. Because, you know, some people during Lent, they'll give something up. And, you know, I'm giving shoveling up. I'm a humble servant. I mean, I will sacrifice it. And there are people in my neighborhood that are going to say, Jeremy, you know, you need to clear the walkways. That's what it says. And I'll say, no, I'm holy. I'm right. I'm really focusing on my relationship. I'm going to give the things up that are so difficult. So I'm going to give up shoveling. Done with it. Good. Attitude that I'm going to take, a posture I'm going to take, which many people will do. They'll give something up. Sacrifice something. Sacrifice something in such a way that allows them to focus, to really hone in on their relationship, deepen, strengthen, enrich their relationship with God. It's time that brings renewal. It brings spring. It brings that opportunity to focus on that which is good and that which is right. It allows us to go down that road that we'll better prepare ourselves and get ourselves ready for the miracle and the promise and the hope that we experience on Easter. That in this journey of Lent, not by law, not because we have to, not for fear that God's going to do something to us if we don't do it. There's nothing that says that you have to do it. But traditionally, some people will sacrifice something. As Gary, which we probably should say not poor Patrick, we should say poor Gary. Gary's trying to get Patrick to understand that it's not about giving up the things or focusing on the things that are easy for you. It's not about picking the things that, you know, just are kind of convenient. It's about carving out some of the things that allow you to focus more time and to really invest, to deepen your relationship with God. But it can be easy. It can be really easy. Then all of that, we sacrifice something or we take something on. Many people will focus on some of the spiritual disciplines, things like prayer and fasting, abstaining from something, quiet time, meditation, these things that we can do that allow us to focus in and to be in communion and community and relationship with God. But it's really easy. We need to check our heart on it, which is where Patrick kind of falls off a little bit. We need to check our heart because sometimes we do it not intentionally, but in a way to try to build up our spiritual resume. Sometimes when we're not careful, we begin to do these things and we get to hold them up and use them as a way to prove to everybody else just how holy we are, just how right we are. Slippery slope. We got to check our heart. Because we can start doing all of these things in a humble and a good nature, in a life-giving way. But pretty soon as we go down along the path, we can start to use it and we can rely on it. And we can rely on those things, those behaviors, those practices, our own efforts. We can rely on those things and think and kind of somehow in the midst of it convince ourselves that it's those behaviors that are going to allow us to stand right before God. And in doing so, it's not that any of those things are bad things. They're wonderful things. They're all life-giving things. But they're not the thing. They're not God. They aren't the things that are going to save us. They aren't the things that are going to bring us back into a right relationship with God. They're things that can point us to Jesus Christ, who is the thing, who is the one, who is the way, the truth, and the life, Scripture tells us. But these things aren't ways to boast or ways to become proud. We need to ask ourselves, why is it we do what we do? Are we doing it for recognition or are we doing it because we're responding to the reality of who God is? We take these things, we do them in a posture of thanksgiving, of remembering that there is a God who's holy, a God who's just, a God who's righteous, a God who wants to be in relationship, and we do these things in response to them, but not in the other way. But in our own humanness, in our own fallenness, it can be easy to mix those up. It can be easy to begin to rely on our actions. And in doing so, we kind of nudge God out of the picture. We say, God, you know, it's good. I really don't need you right now because I pray, I read the Bible, I have quiet time, I have a small group, I fast, do all of these things. And really, these are the things that allow me to stay in line. Paul reminds us in the book of Romans, we've all sinned. We all fall short. Prophet of Isaiah says, all of us like sheep have strayed away, have wandered away. That even in our best intentions, no matter how rich our spiritual, our religious resume is, it's never good enough. It's not good enough. So we shouldn't boast about it. That shouldn't be the intention. That shouldn't be the force which gets us to do it, but it can be so easy to do so. I remember when I was in high school, the Cold Stone Creamery opened up their first franchise in Fargo, and I discovered this wonderful thing that Cold Stone did. The first time I was there, I was watching them make my ice cream treat. I love ice cream. Thought this is the best thing ever. Not only do they have ice cream, but they actually put the candy right in it for you so you can choose whatever you want. And I kept on choosing, and they kept on saying, all right. They kept on putting it in. I'm like, there's no limit to the goodness at this place. And what more could you want? And then at the end, because I was so happy about how they had made it for me, I took the change from the money that I had paid for it, and I put it in their tip jar. Just doing it out of the graciousness of the way that they had served me. But then all of a sudden, they started to sing. They started to celebrate. They started to celebrate who I was. And they started to celebrate how good and how generous I was. And there was something in it that I wanted more of it. So rather than putting all my change in there the next time I went to Cold Stone, I put just a couple coins in. And they sang their song. And I thought, yeah, woo. And everybody in the store looked to see who was the one who had gave the tip. And as soon as they got done singing their song, I put another couple coins in. And they sang to me again. And all of a sudden, the whole place is applauding me for how generous, for how good I am. Oh, it's foolish, right? It's foolish to think about it in those terms. I was tipping because of the way that I'd been served. But we can tend to do that. We can start to take credit for it all. It's not that any of those things are bad. Got to get that straight. It's not a message to beat anybody else, but we got to remember, where's our heart? We need to check our heart. That what is it that we rely on that allows us to stand right before a God who's holy? Is it what God has done, or is it what we try to do? Seems to be something that Jesus was running into. Jesus saw people who were kind of losing their way, kind of falling off the path, going down this slippery slope. And in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, in the middle of this powerful message that Jesus pours himself out to the crowd of people who had come to hear him teach, Jesus says these powerful words into his day, which speaks so powerfully to each and every single one of us today. Jesus says, watch out, Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. Watch out, be careful. Don't do your good deeds publicly to be admired by others, for you'll lose the reward from your Father in heaven. When you give to somebody in need, don't do it as the hypocrites do, blowing the trumpets in the synagogues and streets to call attention to their acts of charity. Tell you the truth, they've received all the reward they will ever get. But when you give to someone in need, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Give your gifts in private, and your Father who sees everything will reward you. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who love to pray publicly on the street corners and in the synagogues where everybody can see them. I tell you the truth, it's all the reward they'll get. But when you pray, go away by yourself. Shut the door behind you and pray to your Father in private. Then your Father who sees everything will reward you. It's not that Jesus doesn't want to do good deeds. It's not that Jesus doesn't want us to pray. It's not that as a church we should stop doing things as a community in the midst of one another. But Jesus says, be careful, because sometimes we will do it in such a way to make sure everybody knows who we are. We do it in a such a way, we lose our way just a little bit, we get a little bit off base, and we begin to do it for the ego strokes that we get. We do it, Jesus says, don't be like the hypocrites who go onto the street corners and they pray publicly and they use all of these eloquent words and all of this special language so that when people hear them pray, they'll say, oh, look at how good they are. Oh, they must have it all together. They're so good. They're so holy. And you start to become a little self-righteous, don't you? You start to look at other people who don't do it the way that you do, and you start to almost take pity on them. Almost feel sorry for them. Jesus says, do what you do and do it in privacy, because it's there where you can check your motive. It's there where you're giving because of the way that you've been given. It's there where you're serving because the way in which through God, through Jesus Christ, has served you. This Lent season, we're building churches in Ghana. This is the second time we've done this. that there are people in Ghana, Africa, who are desiring, who want to have a church, but they don't have the means to build it. And so we believe as a community that we can respond to this, that as a community we can move with one another in such a way that we can provide a church for people who don't have one. We can provide Bibles for people who don't have them. But we don't do it as a way that everybody in Ghana will walk into a church and our name will be emblazoned on the entrance. It's not like we're doing it so that we can be recognized, so that everyone can see how good we are. We're doing it because we're responding to a God who's blessed us in such a way, and that joy overflows from within us. We don't do it in such a way that if one person individually gives $3,500 that you get to name the church after you. No. So we're doing it because God's worked in our life in such a way that we can't not do it. And in giving and in our generosity points us back to the one who is generous to us. And 2 years ago, we did the same thing, and well over 100 churches were built in Ghana. And believe this, 6,000 people have come to a saving faith in Jesus Christ because of the generosity that you have shown as a community. And we believe that we can do that again, and it's a powerful thing. And that was done in response to the Lenten project we had done the year before that. We did a Lenten project called Water for Life. Well, there are people in this region who were dying because they didn't have clean water to drink. They didn't have a way to get water that didn't hurt them. We thought we can do something about that. So as a church, we moved to dig wells in Ghana. Thursday night, our young adult ministry, it's called Revive, I helped to lead that ministry, and we felt as a community that God could use us in such a way that we could raise enough money to dig one well. We kind of put it in front of the community, and we kind of challenged them. Not out of guilt, not out of a threat to say, well, God won't bless our ministry if we don't do it, but just to say, we believe that we can do it. So let's see what we can do. And week after week during Lent, we didn't kind of put up a chart so everybody could see our progress. We didn't kind of fill in the graph to say, you know, you're this much short, so you know you better buck up a little bit. As we were getting towards the end of Lent, we didn't say, well, if you don't give enough money, we're going to chain the doors in the back of the chapel, and you're not going to get out until you give enough money, so you better get going. We just continually invited people to be a part of what God was doing. But it was fascinating to me. The week before Lent was over, the week before Easter, one of the people in our community, they gave me a call. So Jeremy, I want to talk to you about the wells that we're digging at Hope, and I want to talk to you about what we're doing at Revive. And from the very get-go, God's just laid it on my heart that this is something that I just want to see happen. I think it would not only bless the people who get the water, but it would be just something that would bless us as a community as we could see kind of the way God can work through us. And so, Jeremy, if we get to the end of this season, if we fall short, whatever the difference is, however much we might fall short, I'd like to make up the difference. I said, it could be a lot of money. I mean, as a young professional, as somebody who's kind of at the early stages of your career, I don't know if you want to take that risk. I was kind of put in a box on the power of God. This person said, it doesn't matter. I just can't not do it. I just feel God's calling me. But there's one condition. That nobody can know that I did it. Nobody can ever know how much money we fell short. Nobody can know that there was one person who made up the difference. Because it's not about getting the recognition to do it, but it's about being able to do it because it's somehow God's working through us. It's not the money that I'm giving that's going to allow me to stand right before God, but it's recognizing the fact that there is a God whose love and whose grace and whose mercy allows me to stand freely before him. And out of that gives me the opportunity to respond. We need to check our heart. We need to ask ourselves, why do we do what we do? Where does that fall? Who gets to determine whether we're holy or whether we're not. Who gets to determine if we're righteous or if we're not? Who gets to determine who's on the plus side and who's on the minus side? Because sometimes when we go down the path of self-righteousness, of religiosity, we can start taking credit for things that aren't ours to take credit for. It's what Jesus is facing so often when he comes in contact with this group of people in the New Testament. This group of Jews, the Pharisees, who we see Jesus running into time and time again. And we need to be careful that we don't kind of just say, well, all of the Pharisees are evil people. The Pharisees were a group, a sect of Jews who were marked by their strict adherence to God's law. God's law is a good thing. It's a life-producing thing. So the fact that they had taken upon themselves not just to follow the written law, the Torah, but also to follow all of the laws that were in the Talmud, the oral interpretation of the law. It wasn't the fact that they were following the law that led them astray, but it's the fact that in that, they used their obedience as a way tear other people down. They started to gain confidence in their own actions, and in turn, Jesus warns them, start to lose confidence or take away their confidence in what God had done, what God was doing. It's in Luke chapter 11. Jesus is invited to go have a meal, to go dine with one of the Pharisees. Jesus had gained a reputation by this time, and one of the Pharisees, one of these followers of the law, had invited him over to come and share a meal with them. And Jesus comes over, and he begins to sit down, to take the meal, to dine with these people. But Jesus doesn't do something that, according to the law, was necessary. He didn't take part in the ceremonial hand-washing that they followed, that they thought was required, that they needed to do. It was the hand washing that would cleanse them in such a way that they could eat the food that was before them. And so one of the Pharisees starts to call Jesus out in front of everybody else. And he's in awe. He's amazed that Jesus, who claims to be a religious person, that Jesus, who claims to know about God's law, would overlook something so simple, something so practical, something so obvious, something so external as cleansing his hands. And Jesus responds. He tells him, you need to be careful. You need to check your heart. Because it's not the hand washing that cleanses me. It's not what I do. It's not the religious acts that I perform that make me good enough. He says to the Pharisees, you need to be careful. You need to be careful that you don't just clean the exterior of the cup and drink from something that's so filthy on the inside. I think sometimes it's easy to go down the path to say, all I need to do is to make sure the outside of the cup is all shiny, it's all clean, it sparkles in such a way that when I hold it up for everyone to see, they can see how good I am. Self-righteousness. It's works righteousness. To say if the outside looks so good, then certainly the inside matches it. Jesus says, be careful for that. It's not the way it works. My first year of doing ministry, I was green. I had no clue what I was doing. I was a high school English teacher for a couple years, and then I went into doing youth ministry. Didn't have any background. I grew up a pastor's kid, so I kind of knew what was going on, but had no formal training in ministry at all. And because of that, as I would interact with other people in the community that were in ministry, I always felt a little inferior. They had a language, they had a process, they had rules, they had studies, they had all these things that showed that they were a little bit better than I was. That first year we were working as a group. There was about 15 churches that were working together to bring an event to town for high school students. And each month we would gather, the 15 of us would gather at a restaurant in town, and we would begin to talk about all of the things and to divvy up responsibilities. We ate at the same place, and it was kind of commonplace that if you wanted to get there and you had a little bit more constraints on your time, you could do the soup and salad bar. You could get your food, and you could begin eating right away. Other people would wait, and they'd order off the menu, and they would get their food later. So the common practice was when you get your food, you can start to eat. So this day I walked in with all these people who I was a little intimidated by. I went through the salad bar, I got all my food, and I sat down, and I was starving. I was so hungry. I saw food, it was in front of me, and I started to eat. And to be honest with you, I didn't even think about it. I didn't even think about whether or not I had prayed already. Didn't anticipate the response that would elicit in all the people that were in that room. So I started to eat, and after the first few bites, as my mouth is literally full of food, one of the other youth directors in that room takes that opportunity to call out to everybody. He didn't come up alongside of me and say, "You know what, Jeremy? You didn't thank God for your food. Externally, thank God for your food," without even ever knowing of whether or not I was gracious on the inside. But instead, in front of everybody, he said, "You haven't blessed your food yet. What are you doing eating right now? You can't eat before your food is blessed." And then he said, "Leave it to the Lutheran to not follow the rules." And it's kind of funny, but at that point, that was one of the most humiliating experiences I have ever been involved in ministry. And trust me, I've humiliated myself a lot of times in ministry. If you were here at Ash Wednesday, I was the guy who gave the announcement as we're kicking off this big building churches in Ghana, and I stood in front of over 2,500 people and said, "Yeah, we're digging wells in Ghana for clean water." And I said the whole announcement, and everybody reminded me that I totally missed the mark, that I fell all over myself. But that wasn't a big deal because the people were gracious about it. But that event still sticks with me today because it absolutely tore me apart. So not only was I humiliated, but I began to ask myself the question, why did you say it that way? Did you say it that way to help build me up? To help further my relationship with God? Or did you say it in such a way that everybody would see that you are one who is in control? Was your behavior more about you, or was it more for me? Why do we do what we do? Who gets to determine? It's an important question. Who gets to determine who's right and who's wrong? Who gets to determine who's righteous and who's not? Who gets to determine what's going on the inside of who we are? Because it's really easy to go down the road, to elevate ourselves, and to look at everybody else, and to look at them with almost pity. Say, "Oh, someday you'll be as holy as I am. Someday you'll be as righteous, but you got a lot of work to do." We got to remember, it's not what we do that saves us. That's why Jesus tells this story that Mac just read for us, the reading, our Bible reading from today, this parable that Jesus tells. Luke chapter 18, right away in verse 9, Jesus says, the gospel writer says that Jesus told this story to some who had started to take great confidence in all of their behaviors and used it as an opportunity to scorn everybody else. Starts to tell a story about a tax collector and a Pharisee. Says that there are two men that go into the temple to pray. One of them is the Pharisee. One of them is this person who the community would look at, who would elevate, would say, "This person surely knows the law. They follow their life by the law." And the other one is the tax collector, somebody who was despised by the community, somebody who had turned their back and had become a traitor upon their own people. says the Pharisee goes into the temple and begins to pray, but he doesn't just go around with everybody else to pray. He takes a prominent position. He goes into a place where he knows everybody will be looking at him. And as he begins to pray, the Greek, the actual translation of the text says that he begins to pray about himself. Nowhere in his prayer is there any request, petition, reliance on God. It's all quoting what his resume is and how good he is. The Pharisee goes up and in a loud voice for everyone to see, he says, God, I thank you for who I am. I thank you for who you've created me. God, I thank you that I am a Pharisee. I thank you for the fact that I'm not a sinner like everybody else. I thank you that I have a higher position than all these poor people that are around me. Thank you for the fact that I'm not an adulterer. I thank you for the fact that I follow your law. I thank you for the fact that I tithe more than the law requires me to. I thank you for the fact that I fast. I abstain from things more than I have to. And most importantly, God, I thank you that I'm not like that tax collector. God, I'm so certain in who I am that I want to exalt myself and make sure that everybody knows how righteous I am. And the tax collector, Jesus says, stands at a distance. He's far off. He doesn't even enter into the temple. The natural posture for prayer at this time is eyes cast towards the heavens, arms stretched wide open, opening themselves up to God, to plea out to God, to request, to make themselves known and open to what God was doing. But the Pharisee instead can't even get himself to do it. He can't even lift his eyes to the heavens because of the guilt, because of the shame, because of the understanding, because of the realization that he is a sinner and everything he's done has isolated him and brought him away from who God has called him to be. And he beats on his chest, a visible sign of his guilt, of his shame, of his lowliness. Jesus says, truly I tell you, it's not the Pharisee who has everything from an external perspective in place that walks away justified. But it's the tax collector. Because the tax collector allows God to come in such a way to say, God, without you, I'm nothing. God, without you, I can't do this on my own. That God, I'm a sinner who's in need of your grace and your love and your mercy. God, even in my guilt and even in my shame, I open myself to you to surrender the control of my life and hand it over to you and to trust you with it. That's what Jesus is talking about. So who do you put your trust in? One of the things that always amazes me, that I admire so greatly, are people who are going through the process of recovery, of sobriety. I'm always so curious about their story. They lived at a time where there was an addiction, there was a behavior that had kind of gotten its hooks in them and they couldn't get free from. I'm always curious, what was it? What was it that finally got them to turn the corner and go from being addicted to being sober, to living a life of sobriety? And each story is individual, and each story is unique, but there's always a common. The common thread is at one point they were trying to do it all by themselves. They were trying to keep all of the balls in the air and to keep all of the things in their control. And in that, they had such a weight that they could stay sober for a little bit of time, but then everything would come crashing down and they'd have to start over again. It's the story of John. John's a member of Hope. He's very involved here at Hope. He's very involved with our ministry on Thursday night, Celebrate Recovery, which is for anybody with hurts, habits, and hang-ups. But John had found himself in that cycle of addiction, hopeless to crawl out of it. It's not just alcohol. It's not just drugs. It's not just gambling. It's our own self-reliance, isn't it? It's John's story. Take a look.
I grew up in a very dysfunctional household. I became very self-reliant because of that. I got married and was able to put a lot of things behind me, but one thing I kept doing was gambling. I got into a outpatient treatment facility, started Gamblers Anonymous, had many attempts at sobriety. I was able to abstain for periods of time, but I really didn't have that relationship with God that I think could really help me in that recovery, and my marriage was getting close to failure, and they all came to a head when all my other addictive behaviors came out, and my wife had had enough. In the Gamblers Anonymous program, they give you tools to work with, and they give you phone numbers and books to read and a higher power to reference to. But there's no real firm base for me there. It worked for a lot of people, but it wasn't working for me. My recovery and my church life were completely separate. I could still hide and not have to be accountable for anything I was doing. And I was always drawn back to it, that I relapsed. I had two or three real significant relapses where I went back to gambling, and my wife would always catch me, and it would be the same process. I would start back Gamblers Anonymous and become regular, become involved with that. But there was just no real connection to what I really needed as a firm basis for recovery. I felt pretty alone.
So ultimately, it comes down to a question of who gets to be in control? Who gets to be the one that determines who we are? Is it going to be a life where we continue to want to be the ones in control, that we say, you know what, I got all the things in order. I do all the things that are required of me. I check all the boxes. My spiritual, my life, my resume looks really good. And so I'm going to keep everything at a distance to protect, to be able to be the one who is the one who determines who's in and who's out, who's good and who's not, who's worthy and who's not. Or do we get to a place to say, I'm tired of that. I can't hold that any longer. That weight, that gravity is just too heavy for me to hold on to. It's what we find throughout Scripture, people who continually find themselves in a place where they are in utter reliance of who God is. That we read through the Psalms and time again, David's voice, this mighty king, the greatest king that's ever lived, this David finds himself in a situation that even though he has all the power that the world could ever hand him, he still seems utterly powerless. And he cries out in mercy to God and he says, God, I confess my sins to you. When I did not confess, I found myself in a place where I found no life. I found no hope. I wasted away. My soul was groaning to find some glimpse, some glimmer, some hope, some idea of new hope, of a promise that could work its way into my life. That's what happens with the tax collector. In his utter failure, he finally fixes his eyes on the one who can restore all things, the one who can make him right before a God who is holy. And that's the opportunity that each and every single one of us has, that each of us have to come clean and remind ourselves and to remember that by ourselves, we will not be able to be perfect, but we have a God who entered into this world, who is perfect, who gave his life under his own free will to restore us, to renew us, to allow ourselves to go from the posture of beating our chest and to open ourselves and to say, God, I am yours and I want you to be mine. And I don't want to be the one who has to hold it all together anymore. I want my life to be a response to your love, to your grace, to your promise, to your word. I don't want to have to earn it anymore because I know that I can't. See, where things finally hooked and they finally clicked for John was when he found out how his sobriety and faith could weave together that there was only one who could bring him back, could restore him, who could get his life back on track. Take a look, and then we'll close.
I can't say enough about how bringing me to my knees brought me to God. And I discovered that not only did I need and want a relationship with Christ, he wanted a relationship with me. And it went from a higher power being one of the tools I used to being Jesus Christ as the center of my recovery. And that changed everything. It had a profound effect on me. I got into groups. I started to open up. I started to trust people more. I started losing that self-reliance. God started putting people in my life that I knew could help me, that I had a way out. And that the beginning of that was admitting that I had a problem, that I truly, down inside, I knew it was a problem, but I also knew that it was okay, and I knew that there was a way out because of Jesus Christ. I've been clean from gambling since September 9th, 2001. I just celebrated a couple weeks ago 25 years of marriage with my wife. Our marriage is better than it's ever been. It's put Christ front and center in our marriage, too, and it's made everything so much better. It's made all the problems that come along with life easier to deal with. You find ways to deal with everything in life, not just your addiction. I'm able to truly believe that I'm forgiven for the sins and the shame and the guilt and the past of my life, and that I can move on from those things. The clean time, too, that I have, that's God given me, blessed me with, that I can use that and help other people, and that if I maintain that clean time, that it's hope for other people, that they can use my story and see that it's possible for them too. It became to a point where now I'm grateful that all this happened to me so I could have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And it sounds funny to other people, and when people talk about rock bottom, sometimes I look at it as a positive light, that now there's a chance to turn around and turn things over to God.
See, that's the invitation. It's the incredible invitation that is offered to each and every single one of us. That it doesn't have to be drugs, it doesn't have to be alcohol, it doesn't have to be gambling, it doesn't have to be any of those things. But each and every single one of us has an area of our life that we've refused, for whatever reason, we've refused to bring out, to bring out into the open and say, God, I need you even here. That God, on my own, I know that I cannot make myself right. And God says, you don't have to carry it on your own. That when we live in that posture to say it's all going to be about me, that we grow weary, we grow tired, we feel like there might not be any hope for us. But Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary, and I will give you rest. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light, and I've come to restore you, to renew you, to blow my spirit back into your lungs so that you will know that there's nothing that you could do or that you have done that can outdistance the love and the grace that you have, that through the life and through the transformation, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, we all have been made new. We all become righteous. We all stand right before a God who is holy, a God who is just, a God who calls us into a relationship that will renew us, that will restore us, that will put us back on our feet and allow us to see the path that he's created for us. And he calls us to shine that to the world around us. And it's not by what we've done, but it's by everything. Believe this, it's everything that he's done on the cross. Paul says in Ephesians 2, it's by grace that you've been saved through faith, not by what you've done, but by what he's done, because he sent his son into the world to die on the cross. And it's in that light, and it's in that promise, and it's in that hope that we can stand and we can lift our arms, that we can take that posture of prayer to say, God, it's all for you. It's all about you, that on my own, I am a sinner in need of redemption, but because of you, I stand in the newness of life and depend on your promises to restore me.